Part 3. Sustaining Victory. Chapter 9. Plan. Leif Babin. Ramadi, Iraq. Hostage rescue. They have IEDs buried in the yard and bunkered machine gun positions in the house, said our intelligence officer with a grave look of concern. It was a hostage rescue mission. The ultimate high-stakes operation. Not only bad guys to kill, but an innocent victim to save. We had trained for missions like this, but they were rare. Now, Task Unit Bruiser had the opportunity to execute such an operation for real. A young Iraqi teenager, the nephew of an Iraqi police colonel, had been kidnapped by an Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group. They demanded his family pay a $50,000 ransom and threatened to behead the young man otherwise. Kidnappings and beheadings were common occurrences in Ramadi and Anbar province in those days. Often, the hostages were tortured or killed, even if the family paid the ransom. These terrorist kidnappers were evil people, plain and simple, and could be counted on to carry out their gruesome threat. For Task Unit Bruiser, there was no time to waste. We needed to put together a plan in a hurry, brief that plan to our troops, and launch as soon as possible. Our intelligence indicated the hostage location was a house on the outskirts of a Ramadi suburb. The roads into the area were heavily IED'd, and the threat extremely high. It was a dangerous enemy-controlled neighborhood, but that's where the hostage and the bad guys who held him were believed to be, and we had to figure out the best way into and out of the area. Our plan had to maximize the chance of mission success while minimizing the risk to our assault force of SEALs, EOD bomb technicians, and our partner force of Iraqi soldiers. Task Unit Bruiser had an intelligence department of a dozen SEAL and non-SEAL support personnel. At the head of Bruiser's intel shop was a young ensign, the most junior officer rank in the Navy, recently graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. He wasn't a SEAL. His specialty was intelligence. He was new and inexperienced, but he was smart, hardworking, and highly motivated. In deference to the character from Comedy Central's South Park cartoon series, we nicknamed this young intelligence officer Butters. Butters and his team of intelligence specialists data mined hundreds of reports and gathered as much information as they could to help facilitate our planning. Meanwhile, we, the Task Unit Bruiser SEALs, set about putting together the plan. As Charlie Platoon Commander, I would serve as Assault Force Commander for more than a dozen SEALs, an EOD technician, and 15 Iraqi soldiers who would enter and clear the house. Jocko, as Task Unit Bruiser Commander, would be the Ground Force Commander with responsibility for command and control of all assets, the Assault Force, our vehicles, aircraft, and any other supporting elements involved in the operation. With the clock ticking, we analyzed the mission, laid out what intelligence we had, and detailed the supporting assets that were available, our own armored Humvees and two U.S. Navy HH-60 Seahawk helicopters. We put together a solid plan. A small team of SEAL snipers would clandestinely move into position some distance away to maintain eyes on the target and cover our assault force as we approach the target building. Our assault force would then enter the house, clear all rooms, eliminate threats, and with any luck, recover the hostage. Jocko would remain with the vehicles and coordinate supporting assets until the target building was clear. We would all then return to base and get the hostage to medical care. Moving with a purpose, I drove across Camp Ramadi, the large U.S. base on the outskirts of the city where the bulk of American forces lived and worked, for a quick meeting with the U.S. Army company commander in charge of the area where the target building was located. The major and his company had been deployed to Ramadi for more than a year. They had fought fierce battles against a deadly enemy all through this particular section of the city, had lost several brave soldiers, and suffered many more wounded. He knew the neighborhood like the back of his hand. His tanks and troopers would support us on this operation in the event we got in a bind. The major and his company were U.S. Army National Guardsmen, which meant that at home, they were part-time soldiers. Back in the world, he was a school teacher. But here in Ramadi, he and his men were full-time warriors and damn good ones. He was an outstanding combat leader and professional officer. We had tremendous respect for the major and his company and valued his expertise in the area. I went over our plan with him, and he gave me some pointers as to how we could best get into the area undetected and how his Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles might best support us. I listened carefully. Back at our SEAL camp, known as Shark Base, we finalized an innovative plan designed to catch the terrorists by surprise and reduce the risk to our force while giving us the greatest chance of success. We then gathered all the SEAL operators in the mission planning space to brief the plan. In addition to the SEALs, EOD bomb technicians, and interpreters who would accompany us on the operation, we would link up later and brief the Iraqi troops. We pulled in the key support personnel from our task unit who would remain behind and man the TOC. It was critical that we all understood the plan, how and when to communicate, and what to do if and when things went wrong. Time was of the essence if we were to succeed in this hostage rescue. Quickly, we powered through the brief. I gave my closing comments as Assault Force Commander. Our shooters had just been fed a lot of information. My final remarks were a way to prioritize that information, the three most important things I wanted the Assault Force to remember and keep first and foremost in their minds. 1. Maintain the element of surprise. Stealth is more important than speed as we approach the target. 2. After the breach, once we make entry, speed is most important. Let's get this target cleared and secured in a hurry. 3. Good PID, or positive identification, of any potential threats. Be wary not to injure the hostage, and be ready to render medical assistance. As Ground Force Commander in charge of the operation, Jocko gave his closing comments. Simplifying the complex legalese of our rules of engagement into a clear, concise statement that everyone understood. If you have to pull the trigger, make sure the people you kill are bad. With that, the brief concluded, and SEALs streamed out of the building. Everyone jocked up in their op gear, loaded vehicles, and conducted final equipment checks in a hurry. Jocko and I were the only ones left in the mission planning space, talking through final big-picture details of our plan. Suddenly, Butters burst into the room. "We just got some new intel," he said, in a concerned and excited voice. "They have IEDs buried in the yard and bunkered machine gun positions in the house." It meant the terrorists holding this hostage were ready for a fight, and the risk to our force was high. Butters stared at us with a grave look of concern. Jocko looked at me. "I guess you guys are going to get some," he said with a confident smile and a nod. He fully understood the risks, but he also knew our plan was sound and our assault force and supporting assets were well prepared to meet the enemy threat. "I guess so," I said, smiling back at Jocko and nodding in agreement, adding a phrase we use when facing anything particularly challenging or miserable. "Good times." We walked out to the vehicles where our SEAL assaulters and vehicle crews were standing by, ready to depart. "Here's the latest intel update," I passed to the troops. I told them about the reported IEDs in the yard and bunker machine gun positions. "Roger that," came the response from several SEALs. "Let's get some." They were fired up. That was the task unit bruiser way. It wasn't cockiness or overconfidence. On the contrary, each man knew this was a dangerous operation and that he might very well come home in a body bag. But despite the new intelligence, we were confident in our plan. Our goal was to maintain the element of surprise and hit the bad guys before they even realized we were there. This would give us the greatest chance to rescue the hostage alive and protect SEAL assaulters from enemy threats. After the brief, each individual operator understood the overall plan, his specific role, and what to do if things went wrong. Then, we quickly walked through the operation and rehearsal with full gear. As a result, we were confident we could execute with proficiency. We had addressed and mitigated every risk that we could through planning. But every risk could not be controlled. This mission was inherently dangerous. Whether or not we could rescue the hostage alive would remain to be seen. We loaded up our vehicles and launched on the operation, driving out the gate and into the darkness. As we staged our vehicles some distance away, the assault force dismounted and lined up in patrol formation. I listened for updates from our sniper overwatch on my radio. "No movement on target," they reported. "All looks quiet." Of course, that didn't mean all was truly quiet, but only that they couldn't see any movement. The night was dark as the assault force stepped off and swiftly but silently made our way up to the target building. As the assault force commander, I served as a double check to my point man's navigation to ensure that we were in the right place. I kept my head on a swivel, constantly looking around to keep an eye on the target building and on the rest of the assault force. As we crept closer, you could feel the tension rising. Once at the target, EOD led the way, scanning for IED threats. Our SEAL breach team moved to the entry door and placed a big explosive breaching charge on the door. Boom! It's on, I thought to myself. With an Iraqi hostage to rescue, we had planned to let the Iraqi soldiers lead the way. But typical for our partner force, they choked with fear and balked at stepping over the shattered and twisted metal of the door and into the smoke-filled room beyond. From here, every nanosecond counted. Our SEAL combat advisors, ready for this contingency, grabbed the Iraqi soldiers and unceremoniously flung them through the door and into the house. This was no time to delay. Our SEAL assault force followed right on the Iraqi soldiers' heels, and when the Iraqis again failed to enter the next room, our SEALs quickly took the lead and rapidly cleared the house. Within a minute, every room had been cleared and all prisoners were under our control. "Target secure," I called out. No shots had been fired. Now we had to figure out who we had captured. A bewildered young Iraqi teen was among those we had detained. We pulled him aside and, after some questioning through the interpreter, confirmed he was indeed the hostage who had been kidnapped. Mark Lee, part of the SEAL assault force, was never one to miss an opportunity to insert humor into any situation. Mark boldly strolled up to the Iraqi kid and, in his best impersonation of Lieutenant James Curran, played by the actor Michael Biehn in the 1990 movie Navy SEALs, said, "We're a SEAL team. We're here to get you out. There's no reason to thank us because we don't exist. You never saw us. This never happened." We had a good laugh at that, as the Iraqi kid, who didn't speak a word of English, was nonetheless thankful and clearly relieved to have been rescued from his captors. The plan had been perfectly executed. The first clue the bad guys had that SEALs were there was when their door blew in. We caught them completely by surprise in a manner they had not expected. I made my way to the rooftop of the target building, keyed up my radio, and called Jocko, who was now with a blocking force outside. "Jocko, this is Leif. Target secure." I pass our pro word for "we have the hostage." We had rescued the hostage alive and in one piece. We gave our Iraqi soldiers all the credit. The positive strategic impact of our Iraqi partner force successfully rescuing an Iraqi hostage was substantial. It served as a big win for the fledgling Iraqi security forces in liberating the local populace from the brutality of the insurgency. Best of all, none of our guys were hurt. We found no IEDs buried in the yard or bunker machine gun positions in the house, though certainly the kidnappers had access to such weapons. We were lucky, but we had also made our luck. We had maintained the element of surprise. Our plan had worked like a charm, a testament to the solid mission planning skills we had developed in tasking a bruiser. Having the humility to lean on the expertise of the good U.S. Army major and his soldiers who lived and fought in this area for a full year had helped us greatly in this success. Back in San Diego a year later, I served as a leadership instructor at our SEAL Basic Training Command. I used this very scenario for a leadership decision-making exercise. To a classroom filled with newly promoted SEAL platoon commanders and platoon chiefs, I set up the scenario. Iraqi kid held hostage, known location, hostage rescue mission planned and ready to go. "Just before launch," I told them, "the intelligence officer informs you there are IEDs buried in the yard and bunkered machine gun positions in the house. What do you do?" There were varying degrees of combat experience among the participants in the room. "Don't go," said one SEAL officer. "It's not worth the risk." Some in the room agreed. A platoon chief said, "Replan the mission." Several others agreed with him. I paused for a few moments to let them consider the options. "Let me ask you a question," I said to the class. "On what capture-kill direct action raid can you be certain there are no IEDs buried in the yard or bunkered machine gun positions in the house?" Head shook around the room. The answer was obvious: none. You could never assume that such hazards weren't waiting for you on a target. You had to assume they were. You had to plan for them on every operation and mitigate the risk of those threats as much as possible. To assume otherwise was a failure of leadership. That was what mission planning was all about: never taking anything for granted, preparing for likely contingencies, and maximizing the chance of mission success while minimizing the risk to the troops executing the operation. and Task Unit Bruiser, we were able to launch that hostage rescue operation despite the new intel of deadly threats, because we had already taken those things into account and planned accordingly. We had implemented specific steps to mitigate the risk of potential IEDs in and around the target building. We had carefully planned our operation to maintain the element of surprise so that even if the bad guys were manning bunker machine gun positions, they wouldn't know we were coming until it was too late. Therefore, we didn't need to replan the operation. We were ready. And as a result of good planning and solid execution of that plan, combined with a little luck, we were successful. Understanding how SEALs plan a combat mission provide techniques that apply across the spectrum. For any team in any business or industry, it is essential to develop a standardized planning process. Principle. What's the mission? Planning begins with mission analysis. Leaders must identify clear directives for the team. Once they themselves understand the mission, they can impart this knowledge to their key leaders and frontline troops tasked with executing the mission. A broad and ambiguous mission results in lack of focus, ineffective execution, and mission creep. To prevent this, the mission must be carefully refined and simplified so that it is explicitly clear and specifically focused to achieve the greater strategic vision for which that mission is a part. The mission must explain the overall purpose and desired result or end state of the operation. The frontline troops tasked with executing the mission must understand the deeper purpose behind the mission. While a simple statement, the commander's intent is actually the most important part of the brief. When understood by everyone involved in the execution of the plan, it guides each decision and action on the ground. Different courses of action must be explored on how best to accomplish the mission. With the manpower, resources, and supporting assets available, once a course of action is determined, further planning requires detailed information gathering in order to facilitate the development of a thorough plan. It is critical to utilize all assets and lean on the expertise of those in the best position to provide the most accurate and up-to-date information. Leaders must delegate the planning process down the chain as much as possible to key subordinate leaders. Team leaders within the greater team and frontline tactical level leaders must have ownership of their tasks within the overall plan and mission. Team participation, even from the most junior personnel, is critical in developing bold, innovative solutions to problem sets. Giving the frontline troops ownership of even a small piece of the plan gives them buy-in, helps them understand the reasons behind the plan, and better enables them to believe in the mission, which translates to far more effective implementation and execution on the ground. While the senior leader supervises the entire planning process by team members, he or she must be careful not to get bogged down in the details. By maintaining a perspective above the micro terrain of the plan, the senior leader can better ensure compliance with strategic objectives. Doing so enables senior leaders to stand back and be the tactical genius, to identify weaknesses or holes in the plan that those immersed in the details might have missed. This enables leaders to fill in those gaps before execution. Once the detailed plan has been developed, it must then be briefed to the entire team and all participants and supporting elements. Leaders must carefully prioritize the information to be presented in as simple, clear, and concise a format as possible so that participants do not experience information overload. The planning process and briefing must be a forum that encourages discussion, questions, and clarification from even the most junior personnel. If frontline troops are unclear about the plan and yet are too intimidated to ask questions, the team's ability to effectively execute the plan radically decreases. Thus, leaders must ask questions of their troops, encourage interaction, and ensure their teams understand the plan. Following a successful brief, all members participating in an operation will understand the strategic mission, the commander's intent, the specific mission of the team, and their individual roles within that mission. They will understand contingencies, likely challenges that might arise, and how to respond. The test for a successful brief is simple. Do the team and the supporting elements understand it? The plan must mitigate identified risks where possible. SEALs are known for taking significant risk. but in reality, SEALs calculate risk very carefully. A good plan must enable the highest chance of mission success while mitigating as much risk as possible. There are some risks that simply cannot be mitigated, and leaders must instead focus on those risks that actually can be controlled. Detailed contingency plans help manage risk because everyone involved in the direct execution or in support of the operation understands what to do when obstacles arise or things go wrong. But whether on the battlefield or in the business world, leaders must be comfortable accepting some level of risk. As a U.S. Naval hero of the American Revolution and father of the U.S. Navy, John Paul Jones said, "Those who will not risk cannot win." The best teams employ constant analysis of their tactics and measure their effectiveness so that they can adapt their methods and implement lessons learned for future missions. Often business teams claim there isn't time for such analysis, but one must make time. The best SEAL units, after each combat operation, conduct what we called a post-operational debrief. No matter how exhausted from an operation or how busy planning for the next mission, time is made for this debrief because lives and future mission success depend on it. A post-operational debrief examines all phases of an operation, from planning through execution, in a concise format. It addresses the following for the combat mission just completed: what went right, what went wrong, how can we adapt our tactics to make us even more effective and increase our advantage over the enemy. Such self-examination allows SEAL units to reevaluate, enhance, and refine what worked and what didn't, so that they can constantly improve. It is critical for the success of any team in any business to do the same and implement those changes into their future plans so that they don't repeat the same mistakes. While businesses can have their own planning process, it must be standardized so that other departments within the company and supporting assets outside the company, such as service contractors or subsidiary companies, can understand and use the same format and terminology. It must be repeatable and guide users with a checklist of all the important things they need to think about. The plan must be brief to participants, geared toward the frontline troops charged with execution so that they clearly understand it. Implementing such a planning process will ensure the highest level of performance and give the team the greatest chance to accomplish the mission and win. A leader's checklist for planning should include the following. Analyze the mission. Understand higher headquarters mission, commander's intent, and end state, or the goal. Identify and state your own commander's intent and end state for the specific mission. Identify personnel, assets, resources, and time available. Decentralize the planning process. Empower key leaders within the team to analyze possible courses of action. Determine a specific course of action. Lean towards selecting the simplest course of action. Focus efforts on the best course of action. Empower key leaders to develop the plan for the selected course of action. Plan for likely contingencies through each phase of the operation. Mitigate risks that can be controlled as much as possible. Delegate portions of the plan and brief to key junior leaders. Stand back and be the tactical genius. Continually check and question the plan against emerging information to ensure it still fits the situation. Brief the plan to all participants and supporting assets. Emphasize commander's intent, ask questions, and engage in discussion and interaction with the team to ensure they understand. Conduct post-operational debrief after execution. Analyze lessons learned and implement them in future planning. Application to business. "We've got to establish a planning process," said the company's vice president of emerging markets. "Our success has stemmed from sending our experienced people into new areas. They figure things out, put a plan in action, and as a result, we win. But as our company grows, as we enter new markets, we need a standardized process for planning, a repeatable checklist others with less experience could follow." The emerging markets VP was an impressive leader and a key driver of the company's overall success. Like a good SEAL combat leader, he was aggressive and exercised extreme ownership to solve challenges and accomplish his mission. While he didn't have much patience for the company's bureaucracy, his drive made him highly successful, and he pushed his team to the highest standards of performance. His leadership and personal efforts had directly contributed to the company's rapid expansion and growth, with hundreds of new retail stores and hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. His team was highly effective, establishing strong footholds in areas that had traditionally been dominated almost exclusively by their competitors. They were making bold moves, and as a result, huge gains. I had just delivered an Echelon front presentation on SEAL leadership concepts to his emerging markets team, and in the discussion afterward, the VP had turned to planning. "I constantly harp on my team about planning," said the VP. He asked one of his key leaders, a regional manager, "How many times have you heard me harp on planning?" "Constantly," the regional manager responded. I could tell the regional manager respected her boss, but her body language indicated she didn't share his concerns about the importance of establishing a planning process. No doubt she was thinking, "We're doing well. Why do I need to take on the additional pain and paperwork requirement of writing down a planning process and teaching it to my key leaders?" But she was wrong, and her boss, the emerging markets VP, had great strategic vision in understanding the importance of planning for the company's long-term success. Early in my career as a SEAL officer, there was a time when I felt that military mission planning was needless and burdensome, I told them. But I was wrong. Establishing an effective and repeatable planning process is critical to the success of any team. I told them how I had learned proper mission planning and briefing through years of trial and error and many, many mistakes and iterations of doing it wrong. It started back in my earliest days of SEAL training. "The PLO is for the boys." It was a statement often repeated in SEAL platoons and task units when I first joined the SEAL teams. That statement implied that the brief for a combat mission should be designed and developed for the SEAL operators that would execute the operation. PLO stood for Platoon Leader's Order, a term used by SEALs since the Vietnam era. The rest of the U.S. military called it an operations order, or op ord. After 9/11, joint operations in close coordination with U.S. Army, Marines, and Air Force through the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq caused SEALs to adopt the op ord term. But by whatever name, it meant the same thing, a mission brief. This brief laid out the specific details of who, what, when, where, why, and how a combat operation would be conducted. The op ord was prepared for and given to the SEAL operators and supporting assets who were to participate in an operation. It was supposed to allow every member of a SEAL element and other U.S. or foreign allied forces involved to understand the overall plan, their role in the plan, what to do when things went wrong, and how to contact help if the worst-case scenario took place. A good plan was critical to mission accomplishment, and briefing that plan to the troops enabled effective execution of the plan. Without successful execution, the best-laid plans were worthless. The trouble was, as a new SEAL officer in training, the PLO is for the boys concept simply hadn't held true. In training scenarios I had encountered, the PLO or op-ord brief had, in reality, always seemed to be about impressing the instructors or the senior officer in the room with our PowerPoint prowess. Through more than a year and a half of training in the SEAL pipeline, there were always SEAL instructors and or SEAL officers sitting in on the brief to evaluate. Without fail, the instructor staff would tear apart our plan, and in particular, our brief, hitting every detail. Their criticism focused mostly on the presentation slides themselves, with one clear message: there needed to be more. More slides, more graphs, more timelines, more charts, more phase diagrams, more imagery, more everything. It was humbling, but also overwhelming. As a junior officer in a SEAL platoon, my job was to oversee the plan and put together the op-ord brief to best capture the tactical plan developed by our SEAL chief, a number of key players within the platoon, and me. I would compile all the information together into a Microsoft PowerPoint presentation, and along with those key players, deliver it to the operators in the SEAL platoon and troop that would execute the mission. While the junior SEAL operators were preparing gear, and the SEAL chiefs and leading petty officers were debating tactics and figuring out who was in charge of what portion of the mission, the officers worked on PowerPoint slides to assemble all this information into a brief. Military mission planning seemed daunting. There were so many moving pieces and parts to every combat operation, so many variables. The op-ord briefing format we were given was developed for a 96-hour planning cycle. It assumed we would have at least 4 days to prepare for a combat mission. The format consisted of more than 70 PowerPoint slides. In actual practice, we had only a few hours to plan for our training exercises, so the long and detailed format invariably left us far too little time. We wasted most of our efforts building slides and neglected important pieces of the plan. On my first deployment as a SEAL officer, we deployed to Baghdad, Iraq. The war in Iraq at that time thrust many U.S. military units into heavy combat, but I didn't get to experience the flood of combat operations as I'd hoped. We spent most of our time providing security for one of the top officials of the interim Iraqi government, and I spent most of my time in the Tactical Operations Center sitting at a desk making phone calls, monitoring our team via radio, and building PowerPoint slides. As SEAL officers, we were so inundated with PowerPoint that some officers had patches made for their uniforms to jokingly designate themselves PowerPoint Rangers 3,000 hours. It was typical SEAL humor to laugh at the misery. Luckily, my executive officer saw the importance of getting his young leaders into combat, and he tasked me to lead a small element of SEALs in a series of sniper missions supporting a battalion of the historic Big Red One, the U.S. Army's 1st Infantry Division, in the city of Samarra. We were able to make a difference and lower the number of attacks on U.S. Army soldiers. But after 3 weeks, we only had one confirmed kill on an enemy fighter and a couple more probable kills. We coordinated with the Army units, but didn't really conduct any detailed planning or briefing. If anything, I learned some bad habits when it came to planning. When I joined Task Unit Bruiser at SEAL Team 3 and became platoon commander for Charlie Platoon, I began working for Jocko. He expected me and my key leaders in Charlie Platoon to utilize the standard planning process used by small units in the rest of the military. He expected us to own it, extreme ownership. Through a six-month-long training workup, Task Unit Bruiser learned to work together as a team across the full spectrum of SEAL operations in a host of different environments. At the end of every block of training, the final phase culminated in a series of field training exercises, or FTXs. These were full-scale training missions that required us to put together a plan, brief that plan to our troops, and then execute. Our performance in training would dictate where we would be sent on deployment. Of the three SEAL task units at our team, not everyone would deploy to fight in Iraq. Our team had to allocate one task unit for what would be a largely non-combat deployment to the Philippines. Task Unit Bruiser, like the other task units, wanted to fight to put our skills to use where we could make a difference. It was a competition to excel in training so that we could be chosen by the command to deploy to Iraq. By the time we were in our final block of training, a decision of who would go where was imminent. Our SEAL Team Commanding Officer, or CO, and Operations Master Chief informed us that they would visit us in Task Unit Bruiser to observe our brief for the final FTX. We knew that in order for us to be chosen, we had to knock this one out of the park. "No pressure," said Jocko to the other SEAL platoon commander and me with a sarcastic smile. "Whether or not we get the chance of a lifetime to deploy to the war in Iraq all depends on whether you two can pull off a good brief." Frantically, we put each of our platoon's key leaders to work developing a plan for the FTX mission, and we began building the brief. But as we pieced it together, it was clear our brief was lacking in many areas. It was heavy on PowerPoint slides, overly complex, and not explicitly clear on the different pieces and parts of the execution. We were running out of time. "We're going to fail," insisted the other platoon commander to Jocko and me. Frankly, I wasn't a whole lot more confident. "Listen," said Jocko, "here's what I want you to do. Forget about all this crazy PowerPoint. I want this plan to be clear to everyone that is actually in your platoon. I'm not worried about the CO or the Master Chief. Brief it to your guys, the troops who will be executing the mission." "The true test for a good brief," Jocko continued, "is not whether the senior officers are impressed. It's whether or not the troops who are going to execute the operation actually understand it. Everything else is bullshit. Does any of that complex crap help one of your SEAL machine gunners understand what he needs to do and the overall plan for what will happen on this operation?" "No," I responded. "Far from it," Jocko continued. "In fact, it's confusing to them. You need to brief so that the most junior man can fully understand the operation, the lowest common denominator. That's what a brief is, and that is what I want you to do. If there is some flack over this from the CO, don't worry. I will take it." With this guidance, we revamped our op-ward presentations. We simplified and cut down the number of PowerPoint slides and focus on the most important pieces of the plan, which would give our troops a chance to ask questions, to clarify anything that wasn't understood. We hung maps on the walls, the same ones that we would carry in the field, and referenced them so that everyone was familiar. We incorporated hand sketches and manning lists on dry erase boards. We had the troops brief the parts they were planning or leading and ask them questions during the process to ensure their piece of the plan was clear and that they understood it fully. That was something we never had time for when we were bogged down creating massive PowerPoint briefs with 100 slides. Most importantly, Jocko explained to us that as leaders, we must not get dragged into the details, but instead remain focused on the bigger picture. The most important part of the brief, said Jocko, is to explain your commander's intent. When everyone participating in an operation knows and understands the purpose and end state of the mission, they can theoretically act without further guidance. This was a completely different mindset for us, and we ran with it. While Jocko pushed us to focus on commander's intent and the broader plan, he encouraged us to let the junior leaders in the platoon sort out and plan the details. As a leader, if you are down in the weeds planning the details with your guys, said Jocko, you will have the same perspective as them, which adds little value. But if you let them plan the details, it allows them to own their piece of the plan. And it allows you to stand back and see everything with a different perspective, which adds tremendous value. You can then see the plan from a greater distance, a higher altitude, and you will see more. As a result, you will catch mistakes and discover aspects of the plan that need to be tightened up, which enables you to look like a tactical genius, just because you have a broader view. I realized this was exactly what Jocko did to us all the time. It was a race against time, but just before the CO and Master Chief arrived, our platoons finished their portions of the plan, and we walked through them. As Jocko had predicted, we noticed things they didn't see. With some minor adjustments, we filled in the holes. We ran through the plan with Jocko one last time, rehearsed the presentations, tightened up a few things, and made final adjustments. Already, our confidence had grown because we were briefing what we truly knew and understood, and what we knew our platoon members also completely understood. Finally, our briefs were ready. When the CO and Master Chief arrived, they sat in the back of the room as we presented our op ward brief to the platoons. The other platoon commander and I gave an overview of the mission, and then our key leaders got up and briefed the details. We pulled everyone out of their seats and gathered them around the map to walk through where we were going. We talked through each phase of the mission in plain English so that everyone understood. We stopped at key points and asked questions of the troops to ensure they were absorbing the information. We even had individual platoon members brief back portions of the plan to us to verify they had a clear understanding and could run the mission themselves if needed. When something wasn't completely clear, our SEAL operators asked for clarification, which enabled us to feel confident they understood and were taking ownership of their role. When the brief concluded, this time, much to our surprise, the CO and Master Chief gave us credit for a solid brief and delivery. The CO said that of all the mission briefings he had listened to during the workup, these were the ones he understood most clearly. We still had work to do to further enhance and refine our mission planning skills, but we had turned the corner by understanding what mission planning and briefing was all about. Shortly thereafter, we received word that Task Unit Bruiser had been chosen to deploy to Iraq. It was the news we had been waiting for. That set us on a path that led a few months later to the city of Ar Ramadi and through some of the toughest sustained urban combat in the history of the SEAL teams. In that challenging environment, detailed mission planning and briefing played a critical role in our success. We planned and briefed hundreds of combat operations in Task Unit Bruiser and executed them with precision. We participated in the mission plans and op ward briefs with U.S. Army and Marines for dozens of large-scale battalion and brigade-size operations, some involving as many as 1,000 U.S. soldiers and Marines on the ground and nearly 100 tanks and armored vehicles. We owned our planning process. After each combat operation, we pulled our platoon together and talked through the details in a post-operational debrief. In a concise and to-the-point format, we analyzed what had worked and what hadn't, how we might refine our standard operating procedures, and how we could do it better. As a result, we constantly learned and grew more effective. That ensured we performed at the highest levels and enabled our success. In such a dangerous environment, it helped us maintain an edge and allowed us to effectively mitigate some risks, which meant more of our guys came home alive. Mission planning played an integral role in our success on the battlefield. The right process mattered. Disciplined planning procedures mattered. Without them, we would have never been successful. With that lengthy story of how I learned to properly plan as a SEAL leader, I addressed how the emerging markets VP and his regional manager could certainly benefit from such a system. You could use a planning procedure like we had, I told them. You should develop a standard process with terminology and planning method that are interchangeable and can be utilized across all elements within your team and within the company. That is exactly what we need, said the emerging markets VP. We need to capture our standard operating procedures for planning. We need a process that is repeatable. Can you teach this to my team? Absolutely, I said. Over the next few weeks, I sent a workbook to the emerging markets VP, his regional manager, and their senior staff. The workbook provided an overview of the military mission planning process we had used with some adaptation to the business world. We scheduled several conference calls in which I explained our process and why. The VP and his leadership team adapted this planning process to the challenges of their industry. Once they had a good understanding of the planning framework, we scheduled a presentation to key leaders with the emerging markets team. I flew out and presented the foundational knowledge of the planning process from the workbook in detail. We then gave the team a planning exercise using a realistic future operation similar to those they routinely encountered. The regional manager and I guided the team as they put together the plan. After an hour or so, they had built the basics of their plan into a brief to present to us, just as a SEAL platoon or task unit would present an op word. During the presentation, the regional manager and I analyzed their plan. Afterward, we debriefed them on their plan's strengths and weaknesses, talked about where it was ambiguous and needed clarification, and brought up points that had been glossed over or neglected and why they were important. I instructed them to revise the plan with those thoughts in mind, under the tutelage of their regional manager. A month later, I placed a phone call to the regional manager to track the team's progress. She sent me a copy of their latest detailed plan. I like the plan you sent, I told her. It has improved much from the first attempt. Yes, the regional manager agreed. And we just executed on that plan, and it went well. As a result of the planning, the team was able to anticipate and address some contingencies. Before, such contingencies would have cost us business and a decent loss in revenue. But now, with our planning process in place, we were prepared and the team knew how to respond. As a result, we continue to generate revenue. Great, I said. With everyone understanding my commander's intent, said the regional manager, the team is able to be more decisive on the front lines. They can support the mission without having to run every question up the chain of command. Our ability to plan is enabling us to better execute and win.